Have you ever visited the grave of someone that you loved and that you lost? If so, you've probably gone there with a certain set of expectations, things that you think you'll experience and things that you think or maybe even you know you won't experience. So when you go, you probably would expect that you will have a time of mourning, a time of grief, that there will be these feelings that well up in you that remind you of the loss that you have endured. Especially if you've lost someone, maybe that you feel you've lost them far too early. Those feelings can be incredibly intense, and visiting their graveside can just well that up inside of you. It's something that you probably very much expect. See, when you go to a funeral, there's often this part when you get to the interment, which is the part where they bury the body if you're out there. Maybe some of you have seen this happen, is you go out and the priest or the minister is officiating the ceremony time, and at some funerals, not all of them, they'll pick up a bunch of dirt. And they'll drop the dirt on the casket that's about to be lowered back into the earth that contains the body of this person that has died. And the priest or the minister will often say, from dust to dust, ashes to ashes. And it's this this language that actually comes from the Bible, comes from the Old Testament, and it teaches us about life's fragility. It teaches us and reminds us that this is something that all of us will face, that as we bury someone that we love, we're reminded that this is where all of us are headed, that we come from dust, we come from the ashes, we come from the physical stuff, biology of this world put together, and one day from whence we came, we will return from dust to dust and ashes to ashes. It I think, is designed in this service to give us some kind of closure, to give us that moment where we just recognize this is what's happened. We're now moving on in our life without somebody else. And so when you go to somebody's grave, whether it's that day of the funeral or whether it is sometime afterwards when you're visiting, there are many things that you might expect. Again, those feelings, the mourning, the grief. You probably expect memories to come into your mind, hopefully some really great memories of that person, things that you treasure and value, ways that they were important to you and things that they contributed to your life and helped to make you you, and you celebrate those things. There's many things that you will expect. But what you will not expect is to see that person standing there. That's part of the transition through the funeral, from dust to dust, ashes to ashes. We move from living with this person to living without them. But on Easter Sunday, we celebrate a God who defies all expectations. Today is a powerful day from which we see God breathing life into the dust and into the ashes once again. That which we thought was so final and so powerful, that which we often experience to be the final word, is not. And we celebrate today that death is not the victor. Death does not win. Life through Christ has won the day. And I hope whatever you have come to expect today, for whatever reason that you have come today, whatever you think might happen here today, that you too will experience the risen Christ and all that that can mean in our lives. And I believe that for some of us here this morning, that's already happening. I believe that the Spirit of God is doing something special. I believe that there are some sitting here today already, as we've been singing and coming to this moment in the service, for whom God is doing something that you did not expect Him to do today. Embrace it. That's how God works, far beyond our expectations. And I believe today He is working so powerfully. I want to work through an account of the resurrection from John chapter 20, if you have a Bible, John chapter 20. And this is the account of Mary as she comes upon the resurrection of Jesus. She comes upon the empty tomb. And it says, we're going to start reading later in John 20, verse 11, but if you read right from John 20, verse 1, it says that Mary got up while it was still dark and went to the tomb. Now, John is a masterful writer. He's one of four Gospels that we read about in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, give the account, the life, the death, and resurrection of Jesus. John is a master at writing on multiple levels. And so he tells us what happened. He tells us the account of what was going on. That's one level, but he also uses so much symbolism and language to teach us on other levels about the deep, powerful theological significance of what was happening, what was going on. And so Mary gets up while it was still dark, and she goes to the tomb of Jesus. She finds that he's not there, and so she goes and gets a couple of other disciples, and they come too. Understand this, that Good Friday is a dark day. Good Friday, if you're with us celebrating on Friday, you remember the day they crucified Jesus, the day that evil seemed to be victorious, the day that hope was dashed, the day that everything that was good and pure and wonderful and beautiful about Jesus hung on a cross with the sin of the world. The day where his disciples realized everything they thought and expected and hoped for was gone. Friday is a dark day. Saturday is a dark day. It says that after that, the disciples of Jesus, they went home and they observed the Sabbath. Because that's what good Jewish people did. You don't do anything on the Sabbath. You rest. And so they went home and rested. They rested in darkness. They rested in chaos. They rested in confusion, trying to figure out, how could this have gone so wrong? How could this be the case? We thought that Jesus was the hope of our lives, of our families, of the world. We had pinned all of our expectations to him. Then he was crucified. Saturday was a dark day. And on Sunday morning, Mary gets up while it's still dark. Sure, it's early in the morning, but she is still in darkness. She's still in her chaos. She's still in her confusion. She's still trying to put the pieces together. How could God have let this happen? How could things have gone so wrong? Where is our hope now? We've lost everything, and what on earth are we supposed to do? Where on earth is God today? She comes in her darkness. They find that the tomb is open and that Jesus is gone. The two other disciples, the men that come with her, they run off and go home. They're still in the dark too. They don't know what it means. They probably don't know how to react. They don't know how to come up with some kind of logic of what has occurred and what is about to occur and how to put it together. But it says Mary came back and she's standing at the tomb. And here's what it says, John chapter 20, verse 11. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting there, sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They've taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Having said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. There's something so powerful here that most of us probably don't pick up. But for the original readers, the audience, who were thoroughly Jewish, and many of them knew their scriptures really well, this scene that we have before us would have brought something to mind. Mary, in her confusion, she stoops and looks into the tomb where she does not see Jesus' body. Now, the tomb that Jesus would have been in probably was rock, stone, cut and hollowed out of the side of a cliff or a rock face. They hollowed out into sort of a cave. And then inside of that cave, they would have kind of chiseled away at the rock face and created a seat or a bench where they would lay the body of whoever they were burying in there. Mary, coming to this point, she stoops, she looks into the dark tomb, the place of death. And she sees no body there. But just the bench is what she would have seen, the seat. And on each side, where the head would have supposed to been and where the feet were supposed to been, an angel that then speak to her. Now, this is imagery that if you were a careful reader of the Jewish scriptures, you would have thought of something. That kind of picture, this seat or bench with two angels on either side, all the way back in the book of Exodus, they were told to create the Ark of the Covenant, the place where God's presence would dwell. And they were supposed to carry that Ark with them everywhere they went. After they left Egypt and they built this thing and they were working through the desert of exile, They took it everywhere they went. And it was a sign that God was with them. God was with them. God was with them. And when they set up their tabernacle, the place of worship, temporarily, wherever they would stop and camp, they would place it right in the middle in the Holy of Holies, this place where no one was supposed to go, is where the direct, powerful presence of God was to be. When they finally get to the promised land, they build a temple. And in it, they're going to have these descending areas of importance coming down to the Holy of Holies. Again, this is the place where the Holy of Holies, where the presence of God is. And that's where the Ark of the Covenant was to be. And the Ark of the Covenant was kind of this box. And on the top of it was something called the mercy seat. Kind of looked like a seat or a throne, a bench, something flat. And on the one side, flanked by an angel. And on the other side, flanked by another angel. And no one was to go into the Holy of Holies and to get that close to the presence of God, to the Ark of the Covenant, except once a year, the high priest. And the high priest on the Day of Atonement, as they celebrated how God forgave them of their sins, would take the blood of the sacrifice on behalf of the community. He would enter the Holy of Holies with the community standing at a distance, waiting for him to come back from this ultra-holy place. And he would go right to the mercy seat, and he would sprinkle the blood of the sacrifice on the mercy seat, the bench, the seat, flanked by two angels. Mary on Easter Sunday stumbles unexpectedly into the Holy of Holies. Mary has stumbled into the holy presence of God who is being unleashed into the whole world. It's the last place you would expect the presence of God. Death, being in contact with death for Jewish people, was something that made them unclean. But here in the place of death, she is finding life, the ultimate life. This is for John a way of saying, if you've expected to find God in certain places, maybe you expect to find him in the temple with all the religious rituals, with all the trappings, with all the people that look right and act right and talk right, with all of the things that we build up to make it look spectacular and glorious. I get it. There it is over there. But here comes Mary stumbling accidentally upon the very presence of God in the last place you would ever expect it to be, looking like the mercy seat where the very sacrifice of God is bloodshed laid there. But this sacrifice, this blood, this presence of God cannot be contained by the grave. Cannot be overcome by death. The presence of God cannot be held in a little box or a tomb. The stone has been rolled away. The presence unleashed. That which was in the Holy of Holies, this concentrated place, those walls breaking down, and the presence of God bursting forth in the most unexpected way. Where she expected to find death, she has stumbled upon the very life of God, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He's not laid there. Where do you expect to find God? Do you expect to find him when you feel, quote unquote, blessed, when everything's going well, when you've got money in the bank, when your relationships are all good, when life seems easy and everything is wonderful? And oh, this is when we know that God's presence is with us. Well, Easter Sunday gives us another story. Is he in those moments? I believe he absolutely is. But here we find the powerful presence of God in the last place anyone expected to find him. Nobody goes to somebody's grave and expects to find their friend, their loved one standing there. But death has been defeated. Hope is being breathed out of the grave and into the world through Jesus Christ. The sacrifice of God, the blood sprinkled, giving grace and forgiveness and life, now defeating death. She's concerned because when you go to somebody's grave and their body isn't there, what do you expect? Well, of course, you expect somebody's taken him. Where have you taken them? Where have you laid him? And then she turns and she sees Jesus standing, but she didn't know it was Jesus. Well, why not? We don't know. Maybe it's because she's crying so much. That makes sense. in her tears. Maybe she can't focus. She can't see clearly who Jesus is. And all of us, I think, if you've ever stood at somebody's grave, the grave of someone you love, you felt that pain. Maybe you've had those tears stream down your face. You know that. Perhaps it's that Jesus looked different than he had before. We read that in other accounts when Jesus appeared, resurrected to his other disciples, this common theme that at first they didn't recognize him. They weren't expecting him. They didn't know what he looked like. Something had changed in him. Until something deeper happened. But here Mary has stumbled into the holy presence of God being unleashed into the whole world. She's still in darkness. She's still confused. She still doesn't know exactly what to make of it. Verse 15, Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" Kind of some obvious answers, aren't there? Because Jesus is dead. Because I've loved him and he's gone. Because I followed him, and now it appears that following Jesus leads to death. That all of our purpose and meaning that we had pinned to Jesus was nailed to a cross, and now we are left hopeless. Because today I am standing at a grave that I never thought I would be standing at. Why am I weeping? Because death wins. Because death hurts. Because all my hopes have been dashed, because my expectations have not been met, and I am left hopeless. I want to ask you this morning, what makes you cry? What are the things in life that make you weep? There's probably some obvious answers there too. Some of them are very common to all of us, to humanity. Maybe you, like me, woke up this morning and you read news of Sri Lanka and bombs that went off in tourist destinations and a number of churches killing almost 200 people, and maybe it caused you to weep. Maybe it causes you to think about the evil of the world and to wonder, how is it as human beings that we could do this to one another? And maybe you start to think that this world has no hope. It's just the train off the rails. It causes you to lose hope. Maybe the loss of loved ones, the loss of relationships. Maybe your worries and anxieties. There's all kinds of answers. What is it that makes you weep? Evidence in this world that it's broken. Evidence in our lives that we are broken. Wondering if things will get better or can get better. Sometimes a complete loss of hope. Dust to dust, ashes to ashes. We live for a while and then we die. Is that all that there is? We experience this personally, corporately, it means together, and even universally as the human race. We too cry and wonder, are things going to get better? And how could this have happened? And is there any hope? But remember, on Easter Sunday, Mary has shown up with all those expectations, and God will completely defy her expectations. And so too will he with us. Jesus continues. He asks, "Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, and this is the hinge, get this, this is the hinge of Mary's understanding, where she had come in darkness, where she had continued in confusion. This is where the lights go on. This is where, some way, not just her physical eyes, but something deep in her heart, the light turns on and she sees. If she's expected to find the body of Jesus, or at least the grave, she doesn't find Jesus. And now he asks, why do you weep? Obviously, this hurts so much. Who have you come seeking? Who are you trying to find here? And well, I'm trying to find Jesus. Where have you taken him? Somebody must have, that's the logical conclusion. Somebody must have taken him. And how could you have taken him? We just want to lay him at peace, at rest. Just tell me and I'll do the work. I'll figure it out. I'll make sure that he's buried properly. Just why would you do this? And Jesus said to her, "Mary." That's the hinge. Her name doesn't come across great in English. This is originally written in Greek. And the Romans, Greek speakers, were the oppressors over the Jewish people at this time. Well, one of the great things that they were expecting that God would do through his anointed one is free them from oppression, free them from their enemies, free them from the people who are holding them down and keeping them in poverty, hurting their families. So Mary would have had two names. One of them would have been the Greek one. It would have been the one that, for example, a Roman soldier who was in charge of her might have called her Maria. It would have been foreign to her. It would have been a sign somebody doesn't really know her. Somebody's not really coming to her on her terms, but on their terms. And then she has her name in her language, Miriam. And that's what Jesus uses here. Speaking right to her, right to her soul, right to who she is. A sign that he is intimately involved in her life. The knowledge he has of her is intimate. He cares for her. He loves her. He says, Mary. And all of a sudden, she had not recognized Jesus. And now she turns and said to him in Aramaic, the spoken language they would have spoke, Rabboni, which means teacher. She sees who it is. But he was dead. I never, ever expected to see him. I never expected to see him standing here. I never expected that kind of hope to be realized. Never, ever. She says, Mary. She goes, teacher, it's you. It's you. Jesus asks this poignant question. Who are you seeking? Who'd you come here to find? And I'll ask you the same question. Where do you expect to find God at work? What makes you cry? Who are you expecting? Who are you seeking? In other words, why are you here today on Easter Sunday? Why did you come into a church? Who is it that you were trying to find? What are your expectations of the one that you came to find here today? Because what's being said here, without saying it, to Mary, the one you're looking for, you have found, but he is not as you thought he would be. You came looking for Jesus, the obvious answer, yes, but you expected to find his dead body, which you will not find. What you have come and found is the risen Jesus Christ. She says, teacher, it's you. I hope today, whatever your expectations are of having come here, and all of us different. Somebody might have dragged you here. You might have accepted an invitation and you don't normally come to a church. It might be that you come every single week to church. It might be that Easter, for some traditional way for you, means you show up to church and you weren't really looking for anything significant. But the question is so poignant for us. Who are you seeking? Who will you find? I believe today God is doing something powerful. And for some of us in this room, we never expected to find is exactly what God is going to show us today. The resurrected Jesus, the powerful, present, loving God who has conquered death, who wants to speak your personal name and show you what he can do in the world. Who are you seeking? Who do you think you're going to find today? This is a great invitation to experience a transition from the Jesus who we find on the page, the Jesus of our biases, the Jesus of our upbringing, even the Jesus of history, and to experience him as the risen Christ, the cosmic King of the universe. Some of us, we've got Jesus in a little box of who our Sunday school teacher told us he is, who our parents told us he is, who we imagined him to be, maybe even somebody who's just written on this page and is far off. Today, the invitation is to come and to not find less than that, but to find so much more than that, to experience the risen Christ, the cosmic King of the universe. He is not stuck in history in the past. He is not stuck in a tomb dead. He is alive and well and working in the world, and he continues to call us by name. It's the hope of the risen Christ. Defies our expectations. Blows them away. He won't do less than we expect. He'll do far, far more. Look what he says in verse 17 to Mary. Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, 'I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God.'" Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and that he had said these things to her. Picture Mary now, and some of the other Gospels tells us more explicitly, but as she sees him, "Teacher, now I know who you are, you're Jesus," that she probably just fell down to her knees, and one of the other Gospels says she's grabbing onto his feet, clinging to him, literally clinging to him. You can just picture, probably still weeping, "I can't believe you're here, I can't believe you're here, I thought you were dead, I thought you were gone, I never expected this." And Jesus says, "Don't cling to me, For I have not yet ascended to the Father. It's this kind of mysterious thing. You read that, you say, what do you mean? This is John again, working on different levels. Probably she's literally clinging to him, literally grabbing onto Jesus. I don't want to ever, ever let you go. She's probably figuratively clinging to all of her expectations of him. My teacher, the one that physically walked with us and taught us and showed us life, the one that we thought was going to maybe take a physical, actual throne in power in the temple or in the political world of Israel. And Jesus says, don't cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Don't cling to all the things that you think I am or the ways you've already experienced me, because I am about to show you something greater. I am ascending to the Father, taking my rightful throne as the King of the universe. I am not just a teacher. I am not just someone who has been ministering for the last few years. I am the one through God, whom God is bringing all things together. Don't cling to me. I will not do less than you expect. I will do far more. I am ascending to the throne of God, to my Father. I am taking my rightful place as the ruler of the universe. Now go tell my brothers, this isn't a male thing, brothers, sisters, my spiritual family, the other disciples, go tell them I'm ascending to my Father and your Father. My God and your God, that is, my Father who has raised me from the dead, my God who has conquered death, is your Father and is your God. And what he's done for me is what he wants to do for you. What he has done in me is what he's doing in the entire universe, in all of creation. He's breathing life and breath back into the ashes. Death is defeated. And what he has done for me, the benefits I'm reaping, are the benefits you will reap. Are there places in your life where you have no hope? Dust to dust, ashes to ashes. We just die. We hurt. We experience evil. God breathing life in the last places you would expect through Jesus Christ. And don't cling to your conceptions of me if they aren't bigger than you could ever imagine. I am ascending to the throne of God, and my Father's your Father. My God is your God. God is recreating everything. He's blowing apart our expectations. Do you know what many of our expectations as Christians are of what the Christian life is about? If we believe the right things and say the right prayer, then when we die, our spirits will float off to heaven. That is not Christianity. That is a pagan notion. I believe in the afterlife, that we're with God forever, but it comes through this. If our spirits, our souls just floated off into heaven, there'd be no point to the resurrection. The resurrection, Jesus bodily being resurrected, that is his physicality being resurrected, is God saying yes and amen to the physical world, to saying, I'm not just going to say the world just is going to go to hell, but one day I'll just kind of will float your souls away from it and save you. That's a pagan way of thinking, not a Christian way of thinking. In Christ and in the resurrection, we see God saying, this universe is good. It's broken down, but it's good. But I am going to breathe new life into it, into the places you least expect, into the places you think have the least hope, into death, into injustice, into oppression, into poverty, into the places of the world where you look and say, oh, there's no hope for this. This is just, you know, hopefully God will take us away to heaven because this is just done. No, the resurrection is God saying, in Jesus, I'm doing what I'm going to do in the whole creation. Have hope in the ashes. God is breathing life back into the world. And in your life and in my life and communally in our world, the places we least expect to find God are the places he shows up. We know that because Jesus showed up in the places we least expected to find him, with the quote-unquote sinners, with the people who are far from God, with the people who hurt the most. Jesus shows up and people come along and say, oh, there he is again, partying with the sinners. Yes, breathing hope into the ashes and into your life and my life, into the world's life, the places we least expect him. And the things we least expect him to do is exactly what we should expect him to do. As the cosmic king, bringing the world back to himself, making all things new. In Colossians 1, the Apostle Paul said it this way, speaking of Jesus, he said, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Firstborn, which means there's going to be more. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. Guess who has power? Nobody more so than Jesus. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things. And in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body of the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Did you get it? Through him to reconcile to himself all things. He came to live and die. To reconcile everything, to bring back to himself. He was resurrected to show us it's possible, and God is doing it. Today, if there's a spot in your life where you've lost hope, where you don't think there's a way forward, where you think it's just too oppressive, and for whatever reason, you're not going to come back from it, then you stand at the empty tomb, and maybe today you'll hear Jesus call you by name. And you'll turn, and maybe the tears will just be wiped away for enough time for you to look and see Jesus and for him to say whatever your expectations are, I'm going to far exceed them. I'm the cosmic king of the universe, and by the spirit and power of God, I'm putting it all back together. Paul says he is preeminent, having paramount rank, dignity, or importance, surpassing all others and surpassing our expectations. This is hope, a feeling of expectation and desire for a particular thing to happen, saying, believe it, bank on it. This is who Jesus is. This is what he is doing. It seems unbelievable. It seems like the kind of thing that doesn't happen, like when you go to somebody's grave and you find them standing there. That's what we celebrate on Easter Sunday. There's this mistake that Mary makes, put in there, or maybe not. I don't know if you caught it. When she came and she was trying to find out where the body of Jesus was, and she didn't see it, and then all of a sudden she's talking to Jesus, but she doesn't see him yet. It says that supposing that he was the gardener, she just assumed that this guy who had showed up was the landscaper. He's in charge of the grass and the flowers and making sure that the tomb and the cemetery, whatever, is kept up well. What a silly mistake. Or is it? See, John's gospel, he writes very particularly in a way that mirrors the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible, especially the first three chapters, where it talks about God creating the world. And in John's gospel, his first chapter starts out unmistakably like Genesis does, but speaking of Jesus, speaking of a new day when God would recreate, when God would start, in a sense, over, a new week of creation. He actually makes the point of saying on the first day of the week, when he starts this story about Mary, he might have said the third day after Jesus being crucified, but he says the first day of the week, the first day of the new week of recreation, of God putting everything back together. And in Genesis, we read that God takes the darkness and the chaos, everything that's wrong, and he puts it together to create life, to create space for life in the earth, and then to fill it with life. And then we read that the first setting is a garden. And he steps into it and he walks with people. And now here's Mary in a garden by a tomb, thinking that everything had been lost and all hope was gone. And she turns and she sees the gardener, the one who tends the very makeup of life, the one who gets down on his knees and gets his hands dirty, the one who is found in the mud, in the dirt, the one who prunes, the one who removes weeds, the one who works through thorns, all that brings pain, to make something beautiful, to create the perfect conditions for life and flourishing, for beauty to burst forth. Supposing it was the gardener, well, maybe it was. When she went expecting to find death, She found life. If you're with Mary on that, to experience that, I think that the way that we respond to finding the resurrected life of Jesus being breathed into the ashes is to celebrate. How could we not? To allow our hearts to dance with the joy that death is defeated, even when it doesn't seem like it. The joy of beauty coming from darkness. The joy of growth bursting out of the ground. The joy of seeds planted by God being watered and then seeing a little sprout and a leaf and a bud. And our response is with every breath of life that we take to celebrate life himself today and always. May you experience the hope and the expectation fulfilled of the risen Christ. Heavenly Father, thank you for this incredible gift. Thank you for doing what we could never have expected you to do. God, there are places in our lives where we long to see this power. God, I pray that you'd open up our eyes today. And for anybody who has those places in life where they don't expect to see you, they don't expect to find you working, they don't expect you to make a difference, I pray, God, that today they might know that that is exactly where we find you. And that sometimes in the chaos, in the darkness, if we're willing to look, it's where we find the greatest beauty in life. Thank you for the cross and forgiveness that comes through Jesus Christ. And thank you that the tomb is empty. And today we live because he lives. It is in his powerful name we pray. Amen.